Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Wake up to something different on Sunday mornings by joining me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz. The finest in modern jazz, from hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz every Sunday morning at 9 on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident. To boldly go where no
man has gone before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk, and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
Into the film show with me, May May.
And me, Denise.
And me, Martin.
Welcome back to the film show on Sheffield Live. I'm Denise, and it's a bit of a sad week for us this week. So we've been, well, mourning the loss of David Lynch all over a week now, and we thought we would bring you shush, and we thought we would bring you a show that just reflects some of our thoughts and feelings on his films and music, and we've got a bumper two-hour show for you. So we're gonna go with sort of the familiar format for the first hour, and then the second hour is going to be a Lynchian celebration of music from his films and television. And
although it's going to take up quite a bit of this hour as well, We're going to start off as normal, and then it could get very Lynchian as it goes on.
But we have got some.
Oh, we've got some.
We've got some general news and gossip still, haven't we?
Yes.
Going straight in with the bell.
Yeah, but not that bell.
Joan Plowright passed away last
Dame
weekend.
Joan Plowright.
Dame Joan. Now, very... She was 95. She was well known for her theatre work primarily. She did a lot of theatre. In fact, I think she's quoted as saying, "You just do film when you need the roof fixing, darling." She was a very, very celebrated theatre actor, but she did have like a, well, Maymay was a bit shocked hearing that she played the daughter of her future husband.
Yeah. And then they married afterward. I mean,
in The Entertainer. Bizarre. Yeah, so she was married to Laurence Olivier. She became known as his the wife that wasn't Vivien Leigh for a bit, but she and he were a giant of theatre, the National Theatre, the Royal Court, and that was her first love. Yeah. But she had a very flourishing film career as well. Did you see the Brimstone and Treacle, where she played the mother in that? The Dennis Potter, 1982.
Is that the TV?
Yeah, TV.
The TV one,
yeah.
One, because that's much better than the film. Because the film has Sting in. But then so did David Lynch's Dune, but, you know.
she also had, like, a later career... with that withering look that she gave as the Joan playwright withering.
And there was that very good documentary about the four dames, weren't there?
Oh, with, that's fantastic. I've watched that a couple of times.
Yeah. Eileen Atkins, Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, and Joan.
They
were very, very funny.
They are very good in that. And you get a real glimpse of, like, an actor's life in that as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, going through decades and decades.
And it's like their relationship, because they are a bit competitive. They all go for, like, the same roles.
Is this only Joan Plower? It says, oh, I get anything that Judy has or ends on first, doesn't it? I think Eileen Atkins is very, very sexy. When you look at the photos of her in the 60s, and even now, she's still a very sexy woman. And they talk about what a lot of fun they had when they were young actresses in London as well, you know. Yes, they were learning the script, and they were having a good time as well, by the sound of it.
Yeah, I think we're guilty as a society of seeing, like, old ladies.
Yes.
And categorising them as if they never had a life before. But she also, in her later career, films like 101 Dalmatians, Two with Mussolini, what was the one when they're all in Italy? Is that Two with Mussolini? Oh, I can't remember. But she's with Jude. She's with all the other dames.
I'm keeping quiet on this. I'm not doing any Plowright research here this
They were
week.
All dames together.
Yes. And as they
Having
say,
a lovely time,
there
Italy.
Is nothing like a dame.
But yeah.
Dames, bras, what do you got?
I think my favourite, though, is the one that creeps Maymay out, is The Entertainer. Because I think they were in the play of that first and then made the film. And she gave up other parts to do that because she really wanted to do that.
She really wanted to be with Laurence Olivier.
She really wanted to be his daughter.
Let's get real on that one, shall we? Yes, anything else about
Joan? No, I've done with Joan.
Okay.
Lovely Dame Joan. This one's yours.
I know. I'm on my own with this one, aren't I? The French director Bertrand Blier passed away this week. Now, Blier was a pretty big name in the 70s and 80s in French and international cinema. Once he got to the 90s and the 2000s, he was still making films, but they weren't getting released internationally. And there were so many other French directors who were taking his place. But for a while, for about 10 years, in the mid-70s to the mid-80s, he was probably one of the best-known French directors internationally. First coming onto the scene in 1974 with his film Les Valseurs, which was internationally known as Going Places. And Les Valseurs is apparently French vulgar slang for testicles. So I'll let you guess what word it would have been translated into if they wanted a straight translation of it. And it's a film which I think just would not get made today. And it's problematic, I think. It's about two young thugs just going around France, doing petty robberies, assaulting women, beating people up, And in the end, raping Isabel Huppert. And it's all a bit of a laugh.
Sounds it.
Yes. And it's sort of one of these things which is there, which I think... And the French do this sometimes in all sorts of mediums, that it's like the outrage about it. And quite specifically, like the outrage against bourgeois French society. But I would say, I mean, it was a huge international hit, but it's a difficult bloody watch these days, I've got to say. You see,
because is that what won him his Oscar?
No, that was Get Out Your Handkerchiefs.
Right.
But get out your handkerchiefs.
Get out your handkerchiefs. Get out your handkerchiefs. but yeah, Les Valseurs became a cult movie, a bit of a midnight movie. Yeah, if you want to give it a try, give it a try. But I won't blame you if you think, no, I've had enough. but also, films of his that were very popular, both inside and outside of France, as Trop Belle Pour Toi, Too Beautiful For You. Yeah. And should I say Gérard Depardieu is in all of these films. And the other one, which was quite famous, was Buffet Froid, Cold Buffet. Now, some of these films are very weird. Buffet Froid is really like an absurdist comedy, which could almost be like a Lynch film, actually, the way the narrative unfolds. But as I say, for a brief period of time, he really was the thing with French cinema. Mm. He was like the most adventurous, out there sort of filmmaker, where every one of his films, there was going to be something that would upset somebody in it.
Yeah.
You know,
when the French go out there, they go out there.
Yeah. And, you know, there's also this strange thing about... I don't really want to go into it too much because it's too big. You know, like the French and sex and relationships between men and women.
Come see, come sir.
And with the Dominique Plicot thing that's been going on, there's something horrible, there.
Yeah.
But and I hate saying this because there is something almost like peculiarly French about it. Mm. If you get a sense about it, where it seemed as though, that's okay. No, it's they're a strange race.
Oh.
It's a good.
Hang on, wait a minute. It's not even quarter past. We've descended into racism.
No, it's not racism. They're a strange. It's a strange culture in France, I think. You know that, especially in the art world. You know,
yeah,
the world
well,
of culture.
There's always that acceptance as well that men have affairs.
Exactly. You know, that's exactly the sort of thing that you know. Yeah, well, that's what happens, isn't it? Yeah. Well,
c'est la vie.
So that's it. Bertrand Blier passed away at 85. Trailer trash.
We've got a couple of trailer trash this week, haven't we?
Well, I wouldn't say trash for the first one because this is something I've been looking forward to for years now.
Could I just say? When we say trailer trash, it's using a term.
Yes.
It's not saying that films will
be
trashing
films.
If you were on here a little more often, you would be a little more conversant.
Not all of us are retired, Martin.
Yeah, okay. Martin, you know when we try and get guests to come on the show?
Yeah. I know that.
And when they come on, it's good not to bully them before the first track.
I don't even want to share what goes on the group.
If you think, that was bullying...
The group chat is even worse. I feel bullied. I'm a whipping boy. Anyway.
May.
Mickey 17. Let's ignore Martin. So this is a Bong Joon-ho film that I've been looking forward to for years. Not just because it's Robert Pattinson, but this has been pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. It was originally supposed to be released in cinemas in 2024, was then shelved, was supposed to be released January 2025. But now it's been pushed back again to March of this year. So let's hope that it does actually get released in cinemas in March.
I mean, that's not usually a good sign.
I know. But you'd think the director of, you know, Parasite International, kind of internationally renowned director, you'd think that he'd be able to get his film shown in cinemas, but apparently not.
But wasn't that what happened with the Train in the Snow? One.
The Train in the Snow one.
Yeah. I'm in a world of Lynch. I can't remember anything else outside of this right now. You know, with the trains going around the world.
Yeah,
and everything's snow.
No?
And that was held up for years.
Yeah.
What was it called?
We'll get there. We'll get there.
There's hundreds of people sitting at home screaming the answer to me.
Snowpiercer.
Snowpiercer.
Of course,
someone was shouting in my ear then.
I should have trusted my...
Thank you, Denise. The producers up in the top gallery were shouting.
They did a TV series of it as well, quite recently.
Yeah, that was a very good...
Anyway, Mickey 17.
Mickey 17. But that had a terrible release history. You know, yeah. Didn't Weinstein stop... releasing it, I think.
Oh.
He cut it down.
Another one of his crimes.
Yes, but then he was fortunately put into prison shortly afterwards. How sad. Indeed. Never mind.
I mean, I like the look of this. I like Robert Pattinson in space when Claire Denis put him in space. Good.
And multiple Robert Pattinsons in this one.
Yes.
Which I can't complain. So, essentially... it's Robert Pattinson in space again, but multiple doppelgangers of Robert Pattinson.
He accidentally signs up to be expendable.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the look
of it. Yes, he gets killed and then he's renewed, isn't he?
Yeah.
It's like that.
What's it called?
That Tom Cruise one where he's dying and he gets re-put back in.
Oh, we've got to do the research on these shows.
I know. I've washed my hands of it this week.
I don't know many Tom Cruise films, I'm not going to lie.
It's a science fiction one. I can't do this
Tom
show
Cruise
on my own
well.
Every week.
Mickey 17, out in March, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that.
Indeed.
I can't say I'm that excited about our next trailer trash.
I'm not sure about
it's
it either.
It's not for me, Martin, this one.
Well, you don't know, Denise. So you don't know, but I don't know if it's for me either. It's...
The Alto Knights,
which is Robert De Niro in a 1960s gangsters
Shock.
Movie.
Is it based on a true story?
It's based on a true story. Yes.
What are you gonna do?
And it's the true story of and I've forgot one of the gangsters' names. I'm just Vito Genovese and
the other one,
Frank Costello.
Are they both played by Robert De Niro?
They're both played by Robert De Niro.
I was looking at this trailer going, one looks like Dick Tracy. Robert De Niro is Dick Tracy. And I was like, what is going on?
Robert De Niro wasn't in Dick Tracy.
No, but he looks like
Al Pacino was in Dick Tracy.
No, he looks like the makeup for...
Al Pacino.
Yeah.
In Dick Tracy.
It's just...
This show is a shambles.
I know. Well, we've all been like reading Lynch.
I know.
And we're not really ready.
I know. Anyway, he's playing a dual role. And I think at some point he might have to shoot himself in it. If you get what I mean.
Yeah. In an elevator. He took out his own boss. Yeah. We've seen
6 weeks later, he married her.
What are you going to do? But you were saying you quite like the director.
It's directed by Barry Levinson. And I've always got time for Barry Levinson. And as I think Barry Levinson has made one of the great Hollywood gangster movies, and that was Bugsy with Warren Beatty and Annette Bening, and that is an absolutely fabulous movie.
Not to be confused with Dick Tracy
or Bugsy Malone. But thank you for that, May, for just lightening the mood this morning before the show started.
Yeah, sometimes when we talk about films before the show, we like to remind Martin how old he is and that we don't remember anything he's talking about firsthand.
Exactly.
Yes, well, and then they never thank me for the guidance I've given them on what they should be watching. To just catch up a little bit, that's all. That's all.
Shall we bring it back to a little
Let's get back to some...
Familiar ground.
What was for me this week? Okay, so much of this week's show is going to be Lynch-associated music in all sorts of ways. But all of it is pucker, let's say. And so we thought we'd start off with possibly one of the most well-known pieces of music that is associated with David Lynch, and this is going to be the theme from Twin Peaks, and this always makes me cry, so I get very, very emotional when this is playing, so I'm sorry if I do. Anyway, just leave me be.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Twin Peaks.
DJ MC MC.
I hope you like a little bit of scratching.
Unintended.
I just like to say I'm in the house.
Twin Peaks, Martin. That for a lot of people, Twin Peaks was probably the way into David Lynch.
Absolutely.
It was for me, and it was. It's difficult to explain now, but it was everywhere at the time. I remember it being on like BBC Two.
Two, yeah.
But it was on Wogan on the radio in the morning. Like it the really impact, hit the mainstream.
The impact
mainstream.
Of the show, I think, was absolutely phenomenal. And the fact that, you know, it was this director who was probably maybe wasn't that well known to the general public.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I can remember the first time it came on, and I remember the credit sequence and that music, and I was just completely entranced. And then shortly after it came on, there was a video that came out which had the first two episodes put together as a feature. And it had a 15 minutes added to it, which wrapped it up. Where they find Bob hiding in the Twin Peaks hospital somewhere. And of course, that's not how things... and I think you can get it on the latest like Twin Peaks Blu-ray set. But as you say, everything was Twin Peaks. Mm. And, you know, people just wanted... There was loads of these young actors in it, and as I said, their faces were everywhere on the cover of every magazine, not necessarily film or TV magazines.
But the audience that watched it were not the kind of audience that had been to see Blue Velvet necessarily, or Elephant Man, or
yeah.
Like it was just reached people's living rooms.
I find it bizarre that it was kind of mainstream at the time, and you know, it had so many viewers, and it even went huge in Japan. They had coffee commercials in Japan, you know, featuring the actors. So I find it insane now thinking that it was mainstream at the time, because it has such a cult following now.
Yeah.
And like you say, that was how I first got into David Lynch as like an A-level film student. So yeah, I mean, the fact that it was mainstream at the time does blow my mind a little bit. And, you know, they had viewers calling in saying that they thought blah, blah, blah would have killed Laura Palmer and stuff. Mm.
And, of course, it he just wanted to make the programme. He wasn't really interested in the outcome of what...
But that's Lynch, isn't it? Yeah. You know, the other thing I say about the actual form of the show was it was groundbreaking. It says that most TV series would be episodic, where, you know, there's a group of characters, be it in a hospital, be it in a police station, and each week they would cure a patient or they would solve a case. But this had this overreaching narrative which was spread over, well, every episode as it came out, and things weren't resolved.
And as it turned out, 25 years.
More questions were asked at the end. And
so did people get into it thinking it was like a murder mystery?
Yes, I mean, the question on everybody's lips was
who killed Laura Palmer?
Mm. And that became, unfortunately, became a stick of which the studios used to beat Lynch with.
Yeah.
They insisted that he let people know who killed Laura Palmer.
Yeah, kind of wrap it up in a bow, yeah.
And that experience, I think, as well, also informed his later career of, like, if I can't make it my way, I'm not going to make it.
And, you know, like... Once you knew who had killed Laura Palmer, you know, we're early on in season two where we get that reveal. He did lose interest in it, and it did sort of sprawl a bit. I mean, I still love it, but I can see where, you know, the viewing ratings dropped off a cliff, and then they turn around and said, well, you know, next episode you do is the last one.
Right.
And then amazingly, he does this final episode. He comes back, he directs it, and he leaves you with the most stunning ending.
Devastating as well.
To any television. You know, It was jaw-dropping, the ending that he gives to season two. And I don't want to say too much in case people listening haven't seen Twin Peaks.
So my other half hadn't seen Twin Peaks, and it was repeated, I don't know, about 6 or 7 years ago on one of those channels, and I just stumbled across it, thought I'd owned it, and I didn't have it, but I was watching one of the episodes and he came in. It's one of those classic partnerships where he came in the living room. What in heaven's name are you watching? And I was like, have you never seen Twin Peaks? And then he was hooked. And we watched the whole series and then the return when it came as well. But like, had no concept of what it was before then. Because it is an odd watch to stumble in and watch your other half watching.
And when it was first broadcast, of course, you were watching one episode a week.
Yeah.
You know, you weren't. There was no such thing as iPlayer. I was recording it on a videotape each week, as well as just in case I missed anything as well.
And you got the box set as well, didn't you?
I've got the box set of all the videos when they finally came out. Should we have a look at some of this Twin Peaks ephemera that we have here? I've got my. Right, Twin Peaks collector's playing cards.
Can you see that at home?
When
he showed us this pack of cards earlier in the cafe, he did say to both of us, don't touch!
No, Martin took out the cards one by one and held them in front of my eyes for me to see, but I was not allowed to touch them.
So I might just let you touch one each. Leland Palmer for you.
Oh, wow.
The hero of Twin Peaks.
Angelo Badalamenti for you.
Oh, yes.
And I've also got a...
Oh, I thought they were going to be playing cards, and they're not.
No.
They're little fact.
Collector's cards.
So apparently, Leland Palmer is a Pisces. That's what I've discovered from this card.
And I've also got a card from the Marti Cafe in North Bend, Washington, which was the Double R Cafe. Because I went there in 1995.
No.
I went to Seattle mainly because I just wanted to go to where they filmed Twin Peaks, and I saw the Great Northern Hotel. I went into the cafe. I didn't have pie.
You didn't. Did you have a coffee?
I had coffee and breakfast, and it was lovely. And I also found this sort of train graveyard. You know, like where they find Teresa Banks. And that was a very, very scary place, that was. It looked very, very sinister. Have you given me your card?
Well, I just wanted to share this important fact about Angelo Badalamenti. He likes a turkey club sandwich. There you go. Classic.
Turkey club!
Every week on this show.
You'll give up your veganism now. And it's just like been going through this week... I've been a bit worried about myself, about how obsessed I've been for the past 35 years with Twin Peaks.
Yeah. I'm gonna start watching it again.
Mm. Do you remember the impact that it had on you that first time? Because I'm sure you've watched it multiple times since.
Yes, yeah, I do. I have very, very clear and strong memories and feelings about it. But maybe I'll talk in the second hour a bit more, but I've had a very... weird experience with going to see David Lynch films as well, and it was everything sort of combined, and now it's on telly. I'm sitting here in my front room watching this, and I've never seen this before. I don't think I've ever had a feeling like it before about a TV show. I mean, have you, Denise, May, have you got anything that's had as much of an impact on you?
I think Twin Peaks was just such a surprise for me, and it led me to go back and see his earlier stuff. But I was a bit younger than you. At the time.
Not much.
Martin.
Not much.
But I would have been about the age of Laura Palmer when I was first watching Twin Peaks. And it was a really interesting viewpoint of older generations as well, because it wasn't just focused on the young people in the show.
And... the whole thing, in some of the casting, it's harking back to old Hollywood.
And like 50s America.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the reason you have this sort of 50s-ish vision of Twin Peaks. But then in the cast, you have Russ Tamblyn and Richard Beamer, who were both in West Side Story.
Mm.
Later on in the second season, Jane Greer, who's one of the great film noir actresses,
turns up, so many references that wouldn't have registered with me at that time of watching it at all.
And as we were talking the other day, it gets referenced in so many... Mm. Did you know there's a Twin Peaks Seinfeld episode?
Is there? I love Seinfeld. Which episode is it?
It's the one called The Rye, where there are four actors from Twin Peaks in the cast
with
in that episode. The bread.
I'm going home.
Because it's because George's parents, the Costanzas, have to go and meet the Rosses for an in-laws dinner.
Yeah.
And Susan's, George's fiancée Susan, her parents are played by Warren Frost, who was Doc Haywood, and Grace Zabriskie.
Oh, she is.
She is,
stunning.
Who is amazing. Who was Laura Palmer's mother?
Yeah.
So you got this. If only they'd had Ray Wise, but and then, because then Susan could have been Laura Palmer.
Exactly.
Because if you remember in Seinfeld, George kills Susan
with the stamps,
with the envelopes,
the envelopes.
And there's also Frances Bade, a little old lady who delivers the meals. She's got the one with the rye. And there's another guy, I can't remember his name now, but he had a very small part in it. He used to work at the Horn Brothers department store, procuring young girls to work up at the club in the woods that Jacques Renault used to run. But it's weird, and they must have known what they were doing.
The intertextual references.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep up with.
Can you imagine what my mind has been like this week?
You're just making connections.
Oh, no, it's getting ridiculous now.
Martin, I can't even dream about it.
Because we are in a dream.
Mm. So enough of Martin's schizophrenia. What are we playing?
We're playing a track from Blue Velvet. Mm. And I don't know.
This is for Shelley, isn't it, this one?
This is Shelley's request for this week. And I saw Blue Velvet the week it came out, and I'd already been, you know, blindsided by Dennis Hopper. And then this happens.
A candy-coloured clown they call the Sandman tiptoes to my room every night, just to sprinkle stardust and to whisper, "Go to sleep, everything is all right." I close my eyes, then I drift away into the magic night. I softly say a silent prayer, like dreamers do. Then I fall asleep to dream my dreams of you. In dreams I walk with you. In dreams I talk to you. In dreams you're mine all the time. We're together in dreams, in dreams. But just before the dawn I awake.
You're listening to the film show on Sheffield Live. That was In Dreams by Roy Orbison from Blue Velvet.
Ooh.
Sends a shiver down your spine, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. We can't quote the film directly because...
We'd be taken off air.
Yeah. We may well be taken off air anyway. I went to the Brutalist last night and I really liked it. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do a quick review now, but we are going to go and see it again, I think, because we're going to go and see a 70mm screening at Barnsley.
Parkway Cinema Barnsley is showing it on the last weekend of February, first weekend of March in 70mm.
And that's going to be a treat.
That is going to be... You cannot miss that. You need to go to Barnsley and support the Parkway, as I think it's the best cinema in South Yorkshire, bar none.
So I liked the 3.5 hours so much that I am going to go and see it again. It's big question out of the way. There is an interval. It is built into the film. It's 15 minutes long. It's good. It breaks up the film nicely. I was sat next to a couple who arrived late, ate all the way through it, left all the rubbish, and left early. There's like an epilogue part of the film. And they left before that. I was like, why have you... What's the point?
What is the point? These people like that need to be taken out of the cinema and they need to be berated in public.
Well, do you know, Martin, I'd watched a lot of David Lynch this week and I was dreaming of ways to hurt them in a very Lynchian way.
Yeah, yeah.
So, The Brutalist, it's an absolutely audacious film. Adrian Brody plays a survivor of a concentration camp who arrives in America. He is separated from the love of his life, his wife, who, unbeknownst to him until he's first reunited with his cousin in America, his wife has survived as well in a separate camp. But they are separated for years. It's the dream of the new life in America isn't smooth and easy. He doesn't have the opportunities. And in one scene, he's explaining to someone, they don't want us here. They just don't want us here. And that feeling of not assimilating and the frustration is really well conveyed in this film. It is... Cinematography is amazing in it. There is a section where they go to Italy to look at some slate. Marble, sorry. It's stunning to look at. And I don't know how they made this on the budget of...
It's pretty much a tiny, tiny budget, isn't it?
Yeah. It's and it's really... There's a weird feeling of like... I'm not sure I got the emotional heft of it. It's beautiful to look at, and I do want to watch it again. But it doesn't tug at your heartstrings, which is good. I can highly recommend it. It must be seen.
Yeah.
But please arrive on time.
Did you go and see it as well, mate?
No, but I have seen the trailer. And I think what really draws me to the film is the scale of like things, obviously the architecture as well. So yeah, like you say, it's amazing that it was made on such a small budget when it seems like the aesthetic was really prioritised.
But I mean, you and I have seen Brady Corbett's first film,
yeah,
Childhood of a Leader. Have you caught up with that yet?
Not yet, no, it's on my list.
And for me, that's one of the most astonishing films
yeah.
of the 21st century. It's there is nothing like it, that was stunning. I think they made that for 10 bob.
Yeah.
You know, and you look at it, and it's set in the early 20th century in France, and it's just amazing, amazing film. So we'll go. Are we going to go back to that in some detail?
I think we'll come back to it.
Because there's a lot to say about Corbett as well, and absolutely. About the whole thing about architecture and modernism.
I think we should do a special show on it when we go and see the 70mm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so was there anything else you wanted to do on that, Denise?
No, I want to talk about it in more detail when you've seen it as well.
I'll definitely go and see. I had trouble yesterday getting in to see it. I'll leave it there.
It is a commitment as well. And I think it's a very bold commitment to make and say, look, I'm going to make this film. It's 3.5 hours long. I'll give you a break, but you've got to invest. You've got to invest that time in it, and it is like you could watch two films in that time. And it is worth the investment for sure.
Funny, someone can tell Martin Scorsese that his films aren't that precious. You could have an intermission in them, you know.
Well, he builds it. He builds it in. They build it in very nicely, and it breaks very clearly.
Yeah, which is exactly what was it? Killers of the Flower Moon could have done, but. A little too early, yeah. Oh, no, not with my film. Anyway, we're still going to go back to Lynch now, are we?
Oh, yeah.
Someone take over. I'm going to be droning on about when, I don't know, when I was following David Lynch around, I was stalking him. And,
well, shall we play some music, I think?
What say you, Mamie?
I concur.
I think we're going to play something from which... my favourite Lynch film, and it's probably my favourite Lynch film because it's just the one I saw at the cinema first, but Wild at Heart.
You just like Bobby Peru, don't you?
Oh God, no. I actually...
Bobby Peru.
That scene in that sick-smelling room is... it's almost too much. Yeah. But this is... I think we're playing the instrumental, aren't we?
We're playing the version as used in the film.
But it's worth mentioning, Chris Isaak was everywhere as a result of this being out. I think it was probably the happy coincidence of MTV time as well. His video was on MTV all the time. But his album was a massive seller on the back of this film.
And he then appears in Fire Walk With Me.
To be fair, his acting talents... probably not as strong as his singing.
He
talents.
Didn't last for long, did he? He was in Little Buddha, wasn't he, by Bertolucci? And then that was about it.
But yeah, Wicked Game.
Wicked Game. Wicked Game. From Wild at Heart.
Thank you. never dreamed that I'd love somebody like you. And I never dreamed that I'd lose somebody like you. No, I don't wanna fall in love. No, I don't wanna fall in love with you.
Film show on Sheffield Live, and that was not the instrumental version.
You lied to
that
me, Martin.
Was not
and
the instrumental
I'm really
version.
Glad because I just love that song. I love his voice in that song.
Tell us more.
And that scene in Wild at Heart, we were just talking about that scene because May May, Wild at Heart is one that you haven't seen, isn't it?
That's right.
I think there's several.
It's true. It is true.
Some people have had other stuff to do, Martin.
No, we're talking
job,
about.
Yeah.
He's 35 years older.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
There's a scene in the film where our two heroes, Nicolas Cage is Sailor
and Lulu.
Turns Lulu, come across an accident, and this happens a couple of times in Wild at Heart. There's just a crash at the side of the road, and I think it's the sudden, absolutely dramatic change that must fascinate him as a filmmaker. They come across in the dark some clothes on the road. It leads to the scene of an accident. Sherilyn Fenn, they find her. There's a dead body, and then they find her. What's she looking for? A bobby pin? Or her purse?
She's wandering around, isn't she?
Yeah,
because
she has a head
her
injury.
Her hair's all sticky, isn't it?
She has a head injury, and what's this sticky stuff in my hair? But what I love about this scene is so. Sailor has broken parole. He shouldn't be in this state. But it shows the goodness of their characters because immediately their concern is for this girl that they do not know, who is clearly very, very severely injured. And he immediately says to Lily, I'm going to hand myself, we'll get her to hospital, I'll hand myself in. Immediately, and it just shows their goodness, I think.
Yeah.
And their empathy for people. And because it is a film about love and very violent things.
The violence of love.
Considering that you're introduced to his character at the beginning of the film and he kills someone with his bare hand in front of the woman that he's supposed to love, which he does love, to introduce yourself, your audience, to that character in that way and them and us as an audience go, I don't care, I'm in for this guy, he's great. Mm. I just think it was astounding.
Yes, it is. As you say, it's almost like a little moment out from the film in itself, but it really invests a lot of information about them as a couple, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm getting quite emotional.
Well,
again,
I think for me it's the film, because it's a film I first saw at the cinema of his. I'd seen Blue Velvet by then, but I'd seen it on VHS because I'd liked Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And so I'd seen Eraserhead and Elephant Man as well. But this was the film that I experienced in the cinema the first time, which is the way you have to experience film. It was stunning.
Well, we've got to get things moving around a bit, so we're ready for our second act. So we're going to have another piece of music now, which is from one of David Lynch's albums. Yes, he's a musician as well. Sort of some sort of deranged blues type stuff that he does, which is wonderful. And this has been Ashley's choice of track. And this is from The Big Dream, and this is Star Dream Girl.
Crank up that radio. Let me tell y'all a story. Coming from all around, flying down that wide highway, coming like crowds, like never before. Her being the one, they can't wait to see. Every night they come, dream of her. Every night they come.
Dream Girl there by David Lynch.
And how lovely to end the first hour with
yes.
Lynch's voice.
Yes, you've heard him there. We were going to look for some things of him talking, but he just got... That opened up yet another Pandora's box
and
of stuff.
We've tried to make it like our responses to him. We could have done an obituary. We could have said when he was born, when he died, where he studied. You've got all that information. Let's just share our
if
love.
If you don't know it, find it out.
So we've gone for a loving, and that's what the next hour's going to be as well, isn't it?
Yes, I think what we're going to do is indulge ourselves, we might say.
Absolutely.
Yeah? And I hope you're going to enjoy some of the stuff that we've dug up to play for you. It's not going to be the usual stuff, I think.
No, well, there's so much that is I would like to have put in there. We could have done a week's worth of a playlist, couldn't we?
Yeah, easily. Right.
So we'll be back in just a few moments.
We're just going to get up to the top of the hour.
Yeah.
And we'll be back almost immediately.